I'm Marty Moss Cohen. Welcome back to Radio Times. Senator Chuck Schumer, Democrat of New York, wrote an op-ed recently in the New York Times calling for reforming political primaries. He said they are a big reason for congressional gridlock, polarization, and the increased ideological homogeneity of the two mainstream parties. His solution? Open primaries where everyone gets to vote and the top two winners face off in the general election. That got us thinking about where primaries came from, since they were not on the founding fathers' radar. We asked John Mark Hansen to join us. He's a professor of political science at the University of Chicago, and a few years ago wrote a paper called, or co-authored a paper called, More Democracy, the Direct Primary and Competition in U.S. Elections. And John Mark Hansen, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Yes, thank you. Good morning.
Good morning. So why did the founding fathers leave primaries out of their thinking when they wrote the Constitution?
Well, the founding fathers really didn't even have political parties much in mind when they wrote the Constitution. And in fact, there's considerable evidence they were kind of hostile to the whole idea of political parties. Political parties are something that really developed only later in the nation's history in the 1820s and 1830s. So they really gave very little thought to primaries at all, and in fact, elections when the country first got started were pretty limited affairs with fairly limited suffrage compared to what we have today.
Indeed. Were they just as suspicious of the British system, which is why they didn't think about parties and even think about primaries?
Well, even in Britain at the time, one really didn't have mass suffrage in the same way that we do now. So I think they had in mind a fairly limited electorate where a fairly, well-educated and a fairly well-off segment of the population would be the ones who would choose the nation's leaders.
We saw, though, the development of these state conventions. When did they begin?
Well, with the advent of the political parties, you had the issue of how people would then make it onto the ballot. And a number of states gave legally preference to the political parties in placing candidates on the ballot for the November elections or for the general elections. And so then the question was, well, how are we going to actually decide who the parties put on the ballots? And most states at that time adopted caucuses where party leaders would get together and decide who they would slate for particular offices as the representatives of their parties. And they pretty much exercised complete control at the time.
And it's so interesting, and we still have the Iowa caucuses today, a kind of a holdover from, what, the 19th century?
Oh, yes, yes. Yeah, the caucuses go back. In fact, there's a reference to King caucuses even back in the 1830s during the Jacksonian period.
So when do we see the beginning of primaries?
Well, the direct primary, which is really what we're talking about, right, where the voters who consider themselves to be Republicans or Democrats are the ones who make the choices, that's really an early 20th century phenomenon. So the very earliest primaries occurred in a number of states in the early 20th century. Probably the most famous was the primary law that was passed in Wisconsin in 1903 and implemented in 1904 for the 1906 election. And it was part of a constellation of progressive electoral reforms in the first couple decades of the 20th century.
And seen as progressive because it, what, gave people the right to vote for these candidates?
Well, seen as progressive in a couple senses. One was the kind of power of the people notion, this kind of populist notion that the electorate itself should be involved more directly in the choice of its leaders. Another piece of it was a great suspicion that the progressives had for political parties, and so the direct primary was also introduced as a way of reducing the power of party officials in the selection of our leaders.
And does the right to vote, does suffrage, does that play a part in the development of these of political primaries?
Well, certainly by the time that they developed, we had a system of universal white mandated suffrage, but we had that system in place pretty much since right before the Civil War. The direct primary was part of a number of progressive reforms, like the secret ballot, like voter registration. Women's suffrage was part of that, direct election of senators. So there were a whole bunch of reforms that were sort of thought of as a piece.
But it does seem as if people today are questioning the primary process and whether it does or doesn't lead to more extreme candidates, more partisanship. How do you see it?
Well, my colleagues and I, we collected a whole bunch of data about nominating primaries. So we have data from every state, or fairly complete coverage from every state back to origins, covering statewide and federal offices. And a couple of my colleagues took the lead on writing a paper looking exactly at this question, the relationship between primaries and partisan polarization. And the overall conclusion from that paper is that there's little evidence that the direct primary has very much to do with the current state of our polarized politics.
And why do you think that is? It's just...
Well,
no, go ahead. Go ahead.
Well, there are a couple things. First of all, when you're looking at the congressional level, we have 435 congressional districts in the United States, and only a few dozen of them are even two-party competitive. And so the notion that even if you included Democrats in the Republican primary in overwhelmingly Republican districts, or if you included Republicans in Democratic primaries in districts that are overwhelmingly Democratic, there doesn't seem to be much likelihood that that's going to make much difference, because the electorate's already dominated by people from one party or from another. So that's one piece of it, is that particularly in the House, the elections for the House, the elections really aren't all that competitive. A second piece of it is that direct primaries are actually part of a two-stage electoral process. So once the nominees from each party are selected in the primary, well, then they run against each other in the general election.
Right.
And so if a party nominates an extreme candidate in a constituency or in a state that's fairly competitive, that extreme candidate has the problem then of how they get elected in the general election when all of a sudden the partisans from the other party are part of the election. And so there are some natural tendencies that make it hard for extreme candidates in more competitive districts to get elected in any case.
Do you think redistricting has maybe had a greater impact than even how we vote in primaries, in that parties in power can redraw districts in their favor?
It's certainly the case that there is an interaction between the way the districts are drawn and the level of partisan competition. There's also a very large political science literature, though, on why it is that that congressional districts are less and less competitive over time. And I think the overall conclusion from that research is that gerrymandering, the partisan drawing of districts, actually has a very small impact on that. The main thing that's going on is some broader secular changes in U.S. society and the way it relates to politics.
Well, does that explain in part the low voter turnout when it comes to primaries? I mean, generally speaking, and I think in some races here in Pennsylvania, you know, 12% of people vote or 15%. How do we factor that in, or how do you factor that in?
Well, in the paper that I cited, where we looked at the relationship between partisan polarization and the primaries, we found that there wasn't any impact of the level of voter turnout on the extremity of people who got elected to Congress. So we didn't find any relationship really between very low turnout and extremism, or for that matter, very high turnout and extremism. So I guess our evidence at least suggests that that's not a particular problem. The voter turnout levels have a lot to do with just how interested people are in what's going on, and so we always see the highest voter turnout in presidential elections. Midterm elections, we have much lower voter turnout, and in primary elections, which, you know, in most states are occurring somewhere between 4 and, in the case of Illinois, 9 months prior to the fall election, they're run at a time when there's actually very little interest in what's going on, and people are less informed, and they're less interested, they're less likely to turn out. But that doesn't seem to be driving the partisan polarization.
So what do you think is?
Well, there are a couple of things that I think the research suggests, and they have to do with the, as I said, the larger secular forces that are at work in U.S. society. The first is that communities, people who live in the same place, communities through time have become much more homogeneous. There's been a lot of sorting, residential sorting in terms of income and education, and that in turn has affected the political outlooks that you find in different places. You just don't find as many places in the U.S. where there are really lots of Democrats and lots of Republicans in the same place. You tend to find either lots of Republicans or lots of Democrats. So there's been a change in the way that the citizenry arranges itself across our landscape over time. The more important change has been that there's over time developed a much greater correspondence between people's party affiliations, whether they consider themselves to be Republicans or Democrats, and their either ideology or their policy positions, whichever way you want to look at that. And the clearest example of that is simply the realignment of party affiliations in the South and in the Northeast mm-hmm. and Midwest. The solid South used to be a solid Democratic South. One of the most Democratic states in the country used to be Georgia, which we now think of as a lock for the Republicans. And likewise, on the other side, there were a lot of states in the North, particularly in New England and the Northern Tier in the Midwest, that were very, very strongly Republican. They are now considered to be a lock for the Democrats. A good example of that's Vermont, which was the most Republican state in the country up until the 1970s, and is now considered to be a fairly Democratic state. So over time, starting in the 1940s, 1950s, there's been a kind of gradual realignment of the electorate so that people's ideologies, people's policy views are much more in line with their partisanship than they were in the mid part of the 20th century.
Well, it's interesting. About a minute before we have to say goodbye. So do you disagree with Senator Chuck Schumer and his op-ed? I'm finding a lot of people actually disagree with his op-ed. First of all, the idea of open primaries and that the primary system that we have now has created the political dysfunction that we have.
Well, I think our evidence certainly indicates that one should approach the claim that the primaries have contributed to partisan polarization with a great deal of skepticism. So in that respect, I think it's not something that I would see as a main area of reform.
Do you like the idea of an open primary? Quickly?
Well, what we're talking about here, I would more describe as a blanket primary. So it's a primary that includes people who consider themselves Republicans or Democrats. An open primary is one where you get to declare on election day whether you want a Democratic ballot or a Republican ballot. So this is a blanket primary. There are only a couple states that have them now. California recently implemented one. The longest history is actually in Louisiana, which has had a blanket primary since the 1970s.
Wow.
Ironically, it was originally designed to make it possible for the Democrats to continue to win elections in Louisiana by making sure that any Republican who might make it into the finals only had to run against one Democrat rather than a number of Democrats in the final round.
Well, John Mark Hanser, I'm sorry to do this. We have to end on that note, and I thank you for joining us today on Radio Times. Professor of Political Science at the University of Chicago. We'll be right back.
A Most Wanted Man, now in theaters.
Although you can use it to scrub pots and pans, few gardeners sing the praises of the weed known as horsetail. I'm Mike McGrath, and on the next You Bet Your Garden, we'll take a close look at this ancient and highly unusual plant. Plus answers to all your growing questions. That's You Bet Your Garden, Saturday morning at 11, right here on WHYY-FM.
We'll be right back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. A former mill town in North Carolina reinvents itself as a biomedical research hub, with many residents serving as study subjects.
This data and information and blood that people are contributing is extremely valuable, and it will also be connected to them and future generations.
We'll look at the economics and ethics behind this next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY. Supporting WHYY Xfinity from Comcast, presenting the X1 Entertainment Operating System, where customers can access all of their entertainment on all of their screens.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. We are talking about state primaries. Pennsylvania has a closed primary system. You have to register as a Republican or a Democrat in order to vote in the primary. The state is also notorious for making it tough for third-party candidates to get on the ballot. We are continuing our conversation in this hour of Radio Times, talking about political primaries. The second of three guests joining us, Tim Potts, is back on Radio Times, founded and was president of Pennsylvania Democracy Rising. And Tim Potts, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you, Marty. It's always a pleasure to be here.
Always a pleasure. You're also now, I guess, a member of the Carlisle Area School Board. Do I have that right?
Yes, I'm in my seventh year as a school board member in Carlisle.
And let me ask you, what happened to Pennsylvania Democracy Rising?
Well, unfortunately, we couldn't raise enough money to stay in business, so we had to close our doors.
Well, I'm really sorry to hear that, but I'm happy to have you on the show. And let me just open up the lines to our listeners, especially those of you in Pennsylvania. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. What do you think, Tim, about this idea of open primaries in Pennsylvania, the idea that everyone gets to vote in the primary, the two top winners duke it out or face off in the fall? Would that work in this state? Would that address some of the concerns that have bothered you over the years?
Well, I think it can work, and I wouldn't mind doing an experiment with it, perhaps even along the lines that Senator Schumer's recommended. The problem we have in Pennsylvania is that we have, I consider our primary, a closed primary, to be a hybrid in which the taxpayers have to pay for the election, but an awful lot of them don't get to participate in it. So it seems to me if you're going to have every taxpayer pay for the election, then every taxpayer, registered voter, ought to be able to participate in it. And the way to do that, if you're going to have such a system, can be debated. But I think Chuck Schumer's proposition makes a little bit of sense, particularly given the gerrymandered districts that we have, because it ensures that you're going to have one candidate who is more moderate than the other. So if they're both from the same political party, the one who doesn't have the party that doesn't have a candidate on the ballot can vote for the more moderate of the two candidates who are of the same party. Does that make sense?
It does make sense.
What it does is it gradually shifts the center of political gravity toward the middle, and takes away, it mitigates some of the effect of gerrymandering, which is the real problem. That's the real reason we don't have competitive elections, either in the primary or the general, particularly for legislative seats.
And I do want to pick up on that, but you said something, people don't get to participate. I mean, isn't it more that people choose not to participate in primaries?
Well, if you have a closed primary and you are a registered independent, you are closed out of participating in the primary, even though you pay for it. Now, some people, and myself included, get around this. We have a workaround, and that is when an election's coming up, I look at the candidates in both parties. I see the candidates I most want to vote for or against, and I register in that party. Hmm. But it's a ridiculous hassle to have to go through.
Well, and don't you have to register something like 30 days before the primary date?
Yeah, so 30 days before the election, I have to register in for the primary I want to vote in, which is kind of silly. And then after the election, I can change back, or I can change to a different party for the general, I can change to independent, doesn't matter. But it's silly to force people who are paying for an election to have to jump through these hoops in order to participate in it.
One of the arguments, I guess, for the system is that Democrats get to vote for their Democratic nominee, Republicans get to vote for their Republican nominee, and then they get to face off in the fall.
Well, sure, but the problem with gerrymandering is that you have a majority of legislative districts that have no contest in the primary, at least not a two-party contest. You know, most Philadelphia districts do not have a Republican running, and an awful lot of rural districts do not have a Democrat running. So the party system is not helping to foster competition. And that's a whole different discussion about gerrymandering, but that's the real source of the problem. People don't show up for elections because they don't think it makes any difference. There's only one party on the ballot. There's only one candidate on the ballot, usually, particularly among the Republicans, because the Republican Party has a more disciplined approach to how they put folks on the ballot. You know, you wait your turn. In most rural areas, especially, you wait your turn. And if your turn doesn't come around, well, that's too bad. You're not going to run against an incumbent, or you're going to be shunned. It's real simple.
Well, and you're saying that describes how the Republican Party works in the state. How about the Democratic Party? Is it more messy?
Well, there are other places in the state where Democrats try to do the same thing. But the Democrats, as you know, are not as well disciplined as Republicans. So quite often you will have a Democrat-only primary with no Republican showing up on the ballot in the fall, and vice versa. It's not a good system either way you look at it. But the point is, taxpayers who can't participate in an election is a problem for me. The alternative is to have other ways for parties to choose their candidates. They can choose them through a caucus. They can choose it through a convention. They can use technology to canvass all of their voters statewide and do it online, candidate selection process. There are a lot of ways to do this without charging the taxpayers millions of dollars every spring.
Let me get some callers on, and again, that phone number, 1-888-477-9499. Talking with Tim Potts in this hour of Radio Times, taking a look at a primary system, how we elect people through primaries. It's come under some criticism in recent years, and we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can send us a tweet at Marty Moss Cohen. What do you think about how we should deal with or reform the system that we have, or perhaps it's perfectly fine just the way it is? Let me get Julian from Trooper, Pennsylvania, to join us. Julian, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, Marty.
Hi there.
First-time caller.
Okay, good for you.
I was sort of wondering about the whole thing about primaries being not primary. Sorry. About gerrymandering and how that might create a vicious cycle by sort of drawing the lines on districts, that it might attract more people of a particular political party by creating districts that inherently sort of are polarized in one way or another, and that's kind of reinforced that sort of thing. Another small question I had was, what perhaps the effect of, say, third parties and their potential, you know, people with not really mainstream aligned with a particular party views would be in an open primary system?
Sure, fair enough. Let's take the first one about gerrymandering, since, Tim, that seems to be an issue that is of deep concern to you. Go ahead.
Yes, well, you know, your previous guest hit the nail on the head when he said that gerrymandering is not just a political problem, but it is a community problem, in the sense that more and more people are choosing to live in places that reflect their political philosophy. And I don't know, the place to study to see what the effect could be on this is Iowa, which has the best redistricting system in the country. Everybody admits it. It's done by an independent commission. You know, you don't have people protecting incumbents and that kind of stuff. It would be interesting to see what their experience is in terms of having a really neutral system of redistricting, and whether that plays into or away from the kind of congregation of people living in various places simply because they like the politics of the area, or they like the restrictive covenants on the property. That is another way that tends to homogenize communities.
But do you think the goal of our system should be to create these more diverse districts, Tim?
You know, that's a hard thing to say, because that immediately implies some kind of overlay that somebody's going to put on it when what you want is a really neutral system. I think the goal has to be increasing citizen participation mm-hmm. in elections. And you do that in a number of ways, but one way is to give everybody a stake in the outcome of an election. In a party primary, you don't do that. You only give the people of the party an outcome, a stake in the outcome. And an awful lot of people are disenfranchised because of that system. So if you want to increase citizen participation in elections, then you really do want to have an open primary of some sort where people can vote, when everybody who's a qualified elector can vote for the candidate of his or her choice, and then figure out what the general election ballot's going to look like.
Julian also mentioned that third parties have a hard time in Pennsylvania, and Tim, you and I have talked about that before. It's kind of one of the themes of our conversations. I remember Ralph Nader being very angry about the problems that he had in the state. Also, more and more people are independent. So where does that leave independents in the Commonwealth?
Well, under a closed primary system, it leaves them nowhere. And independents, of course, are the fastest growing political segment. Republicans are losing members, Democrats are losing members, and independents are growing. So if you wanted a system that responded to the electorate, then you would also figure out a way to engage more of the independents. Third parties are a real problem in Pennsylvania. The rules for third parties getting on the ballot are just ridiculous. They're among the most restrictive anywhere in the country. And if you said, we're not going to have primary elections anymore, parties are going to choose their candidates in whatever way they want and forward those names to the Secretary of the Commonwealth to put on the ballot, then you don't have to go through a lot of signature requirements that are, you know, much more onerous for third-party candidates than for major party candidates. You get certified people on the ballot through whatever process the party or the independent candidate has in mind, the Green Party or the Constitutional Party, whatever. You do it that way, and then you get people on the ballot without having to go through this ridiculous ritual of collecting enormous numbers of signatures, knowing that you're going to get challenged in court on everything, and have to pay if you lose, have to pay the other side's legal bills. It's just ridiculous.
And tell us about, we've talked about this before, about the number of signatures that a person has to get if they are a representative of a third party.
Yeah, well, you know, this is another one of those really weird things, because it depends. It's not the same number every year. It's a percentage of the highest vote total in the previous statewide election. So if the previous statewide election is for, as in last year, a Supreme Court justice, well, you know, not a lot of people turn out for that. So the threshold this year is about 16,000, as opposed to 2,000 for major party candidates in a couple of counties. Well, in previous years, it's been as high as 40,000. It's ridiculous to say that people have to get 40,000 signatures, valid signatures, to get on a ballot in Pennsylvania. That's just absurd.
Do you think there's any chance, from your perspective, that there are folks either in the legislature or others like yourself that can affect change in the Commonwealth?
Well, yeah, and oddly, I don't expect a whole lot from the legislature, as you can imagine. But when we went through the redistricting process this last time, you had a wonderful woman from the Lehigh Valley who came up, just as an individual citizen, came up with a redistricting plan, got before the Supreme Court, and really had a major impact on the way the lines were drawn in Pennsylvania legislative districts. We can continue that. Or we can have, you know, decide that we're going to do this right and stop wasting our time in court and start, you know, spending our energies on creating a system that encourages people to vote and makes it easy for them to vote.
But as you said, your organization, you know, is no more. And this is one of the issues that you have fought so hard for.
Yeah, well, you know, there are other organizations. Ours was a state organization. Common Cause is still around. They're still working on this. It's a national organization. The League of Women Voters, another national organization, is very hot to trot on this stuff. They are working on it. There's, you know, there are other people doing this kind of work. It's unfortunate that they're not as successful as they ought to be. But it's not like the field is out there and people are running amok without any oversight.
Well, on that jolly note, Tim Potts, thank you so much for joining us today, Radio Times.
You are very welcome, Marty, anytime.
And good luck to you as well. Former director of Pennsylvania Democracy Rising, currently a member of the Carlisle Area School Board, and the second of three guests in this hour of Radio Times, taking a look at the primary system that we have, not just in this state, but across the country. And as I said, Senator Chuck Schumer said California's relatively new political primary primary system approved in 2010 was an improvement over the old one. And this was in a recent New York Times op-ed that he wrote calling for reform. Well, we wanted to get a reality check, and we asked David McEwen, a professor of political science at Sonoma State University, to join us on Radio Times. And David, thanks for joining us on Radio Times.
Well, thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Very nice to have you with us as well. And we have some calls coming in at 1-888-477-9499. So let's go back to 2010 when California changed its primary system. What was the problem back then that the voters wanted to change?
Well, the belief was that if you could elect more moderates to the legislature, that you'd see less gridlock and less partisanship in Sacramento. But really what the ballot measure was about was loosening the hold by Democrats, of Democrats in Sacramento. And it was a ploy by then-Governor Schwarzenegger and others who were trying to really moderate and be more influential within California politics. The reality has been, however, much more mixed. And that you referenced Senator Schumer's op-ed over the weekend.
Yes.
And his op-ed really does overstate the effectiveness of what's happened in California. It hasn't been as moderating as they might have hoped, for example.
Well, and what he said, and your phone is not the greatest, but we're going to hang on because we're about 2 minutes from our break here. But what he said is if you have an open primary, the candidate, you know, anyone can vote for anybody else, and then the two winners face off in the fall. He's saying that would deal with the partisanship, the gridlock, all the sort of bad vibrations in Washington, D.C., and the California was an example of how that worked. You're telling us not so fast, Senator Schumer?
Yeah, not so fast indeed. If you look more closely at what's happened, Senator Schumer's cherry-picked some of the data. We don't have enough experience to show that it's moderating. If you look at more broadly what's happened this primary season, it's one of the lowest participation rates ever in history, and that's across the country, and California just experienced this. And that's because voters, especially independents, more and more voters becoming those independents, that they're not tuned into primaries, and the open primary or top two system does little to ameliorate that. You have to look at things like campaign finance reform, changing the redistricting process, things like that that are probably more effective than just creating a top two open primary, which Senator Schumer referred.
And is it because independents don't have a candidate, an independent candidate that they want to vote for?
Well, it's not only that, it's that independents don't make up their mind until late, and they make up their mind when the race is hot or something's happening. And that typically happens in a general election when they flood in to the ballot because their attention has turned to what's happening, for example, in November. But in the primary season, unless there's something controversial, a Todd Akin-like statement or a very controversial Tea Party candidate, or even two Democrats that are hugely influential going to battle, these independents don't tune in. And there's no reason to expect that the open primary would change that. Indeed, the data that we've seen so far indicates as such. And so you have to look at other types of reforms. And so I think certainly Senator Schumer overstates the case and simplifies the case. And I suppose this isn't a surprising approach coming from an academic.
I was going to say, let me pick up on that. We're going to call you back, David, because it's not the greatest phone line. And we're going to take a very short break, get back to our conversation, getting three perspectives on the primary system used in states to elect their members of Congress or the state legislature. Again, David McEwen, our guest. He's a professor of political science at Sonoma State University. That's in California, studies California politics and elections. 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Westchester University has been offering graduate studies for over 50 years. Today, Westchester has over 70 graduate degree and certificate programs in business and public affairs, health, visual and performing arts, education, arts and sciences, and their new doctorate of nursing practice. With campuses in suburban Chester County, the new Center City, Philadelphia location, or online. Details at wcupa.edu/grad. Graduate education at Westchester University. Learn more.
On the next Fresh Air, as Project Runway begins its new season, we feature our interview with Tim Gunn. Although he's now a confident mentor, he had a difficult adolescence. He stuttered, he was in denial about being gay, and he was bullied. When he was 17, he tried to kill himself. We'll talk about his life and, of course, about fashion. Join us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
For Richard Nixon, secrecy was king.
All files, any correspondence or anything that has to do with between me and any member of my staff belongs to the president, not to them.
Almost 40 years since the president's resignation, a look at the tapes he protected until his death. That's next time on The Takeaway from PRI, Public Radio International.
Today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen, again talking with David McEwen. And we were curious about how California does primaries. Senator Chuck Schumer had an op-ed recently in the New York Times calling for reforming political primaries. He said California has a better one than it used to have. He also called for something called open primaries, where everyone gets to vote and the top two winners face off in the general election, which is generally what California does. We wanted to get a reality check from David McEwen and hoping, fingers crossed, he's on a better line. And David, let's hear what you sound like. You're back on Radio Times.
Right. Thank you for having me.
Okay, that's very good. I think that sounds a little bit better. I'm going to keep my fingers crossed. Also give out that phone number again, and it's 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can send us a tweet at Marty Moss Cohen. You were saying, David, that this open primary system where everyone gets to vote is that people are not engaged, you know, months before a general election, and I guess the parties are not engaged so much as they are when it's in the fall and, say, a month or two or a week or two before an election?
That's right. I mean, if you look at this election season in particular, I mean, this really has been a series of nothing elections. It hasn't, the elections and the primaries nationally have not been really put forth on any large-scale issue. It's not like 2010. It's not like 2006 or 1994. When Newt Gingrich and his folks had the contract with America. What you've really seen is a series of small elections, and in states, even with the open primary, there's no reason to expect that the race is absent some type of contest or some type of fist fight that's going on, that really voters are going to be engaged. And so there are other things that can be done, like California, for example, has a citizens redistricting commission. We redrew the lines based upon what citizens had come up with, and that was through put on the ballot through a ballot measure. And the states that Senator Schumer points to, with the exception of Louisiana, right? Louisiana has one of the one of the largest constitutions in the world. It's in the top three. Everything is in the Louisiana Constitution. But the other states he points to, like Oregon, Washington, Colorado, and California, those are all states with the ballot measure process. So there's one element here, and that is that if you're going to look at going to open primary or top two or something like what California has done, or you're going to redraw the lines or change campaign finance reform, you're probably going to look at those states that have the ballot measure process as opposed to other things. And so what we need is more data and more experimentation, more labs of democracy, and it's hard to see that happening in Washington or through Senator Schumer's call for a national top two system.
We're calling you from Pennsylvania. We have a closed primary system here. You register as a Democrat or Republican, and then you get to choose your party's candidate, and some people are, you know, feel like that really limits, certainly independents, limits their choice. They can sign up to a party, but they have to do that a month in advance, and that's a lot of, I think, extra work for a lot of people.
Right, and you also have to think of it kind of from an insider perspective, or kind of an inside baseball game, and that is that if you think about it, why would parties want to give up the chance to participate or influence the nomination process? Why would parties nominally want more independent voting who are, say, light Republicans or light Democrats? They might want that in a very close race, but in general, insiders are not going to want that for true partisans. And so there are ways that you might have a modified open primary or a modified closed primary where you can choose to rule someone and allow these voters who are independents to participate. But we've seen more broadly more and more independent voters, or what in California we call decline to state voters. And that these voters, that's the largest growing segment of the electorate. Mm-hmm. So as the electorate becomes more demographically diverse, as it becomes younger, as it becomes much more urban, or as the population trends change, you also want to capture that aspect, and the open primary does a little to do that.
I'm looking at some of the emails and comments we're getting here, and a number of them saying, why do we need parties anyway? Let's abolish the parties and just let people run. Would that improve anything, or would it be just a gigantic mess, David?
No, that's a very good point, because what the open primary has done in California, the top two system, really, that voters instituted, is it has assured that there are no third parties. And so if independents are looking for a third way, or if lighter Democrats or lighter Republicans are looking for a different avenue, they're not going to find that, because they're going to have candidates that tend to hew to the party line, or tend to be, you might think of it as more ideologically active, more partisan, that come through the primary system. And again, the open primary hasn't done much to change that, and there's little reason to expect that will happen. So you do get very ideologically strong Democrats and Republicans. The senator talked about this in his piece. But the open primary only works at that on the margin. You also have very few districts that are competitive. And that's another aspect of this, is that with a lack of competitive districts, that there really isn't much that a few independent voters who are acting in a strategic fashion, they're really not going to influence that outcome much in a primary. They'd be much more active in a general election, for example.
And is it too early to tell in California, with a more open primary system, do you have a more diverse elected representatives? I think of California as a largely Democratic state. Did that change at all?
Yeah, no, that's a very good question. So what we have seen, and if you go back to since we instituted term limits in 1990 and then changed them recently, is we have seen more legislators who are from local government, more from underrepresented groups, a slight uptick in the number of women in the legislature, for example. But we haven't seen the work product change. We made some budget changes in terms of how we enact the budget. This governor is going to get reelected. There really are no challengers to him. And so as a result, there has been some what you might think of as window dressing or change on one hand, but it really hasn't affected or changed what the work product is that comes out of the legislature. In addition, the voting public that participates in June in our primary system and that which appears in November are dramatically different, just like we see nationally. We have voters who are traditional, much more partisan, what you might think of as whiter voters in the primary season, and then the voting public changes in November, and the open primary does very little to deal with that. We have seen some interesting things in terms of the data. In the first time we ran the open primary, the top two system, there were much more competitive top two Republicans that ended up, especially in Southern California, running against each other.
That's
what you might think of as a Tea Party conservative versus a more moderate Republican running against each other. This time out, after this last series of elections, we have seen that flipped, and we've seen more Dem-on-Dem violence, if you will, than what we saw before in the first go round in 2012.
Do you mean, you don't mean real violence, do you?
No. But
okay,
like
just checking. We're 3,000 miles away. I just want to make sure things are okay in California. How about something like voter turnout? Was that affected at all by a more open primary system?
Yeah, another good question. No, not so far. There hasn't been an uptake in this. I mean, you would expect that voter turnout would be higher in a presidential than a non-presidential year, 2012, as opposed to 2014. Once you factor that into account, what we actually seen has a tick downward. California
really?
Just had a primary where 25% of the eligible voter pool participated. Now, that's three times what we saw in Texas. This primary season, which I suppose is great, but you're still talking about one out of every four voters, which was historically low. On the other hand, the number of voters who voted by mail, who actually mailed in their ballots, was at an all-time high, almost 70%, 69% of all the voters that participated in the June primary cast their ballot through the mail. So elections are moving earlier. That makes them more expensive, which makes campaign finance reform much more important, kind of the dark money advent of what's happening. And parties have adjusted to this, just like they've adjusted to the top two open primary rules that California instituted.
But I do want to get back to our callers, but what I hear you saying is that by making it, if people can vote by mail, that's a heck of a lot easier than trying to get off work early on a Tuesday, you know, to go to your local firehouse to vote.
That's correct. So what you have is you have voters who are voting by mail who are increasingly purple or declined to state. They're detangling or moving away from party, and California partisans are a little bit different anyways. I mean, Valley Democrats, Central Valley Democrats in California eat California coastal Republicans for lunch. They eat them for lunch because coastal Republicans are interested in the environment, but they're also interested in taxes, whereas Central Valley Democrats are very conservative. They're both socially and economic conservatives, and are Democrats in name only. So the state's diversity is also a component to this that influences whether voters are participating in the primary season as opposed to the general election season.
It's like we live in a country with 50 different countries when we're talking about how we do elections. Let me just quickly reintroduce you. That's David McEwen. He's a professor of political science at Sonoma State University in the state and perhaps the country of California. And we are talking about how they do primaries out there. And we want to hear from you at 1-888-477-9499. Again, you can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can send us a tweet at Marty Moss Cohen. Let me get Shannon from Exton, PA to join us. Shannon, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi there.
I know I have come from originally Southern California to Virginia to Pennsylvania, and in my early life, I've been registered as a Republican, a Democrat, and an independent.
Wow.
And I have to speak to the comments about the independents not being involved. I still consider myself an independent. I have to be registered with a party just for the sake that I feel it's important to be able to vote in the primaries.
Right.
But I've never voted state party line. I have a lot of friends that feel the same way. Some are Chester County. They're Republicans in name only because it's the only way they have a say in the primaries as far as they're concerned.
Well, do you resent that, Shannon? I mean, do you feel like that's...
I resent it a lot. I think that the way Pennsylvania is set up is so disenfranchising to any independent. I mean, I don't really line myself up with the Green Party or the Libertarian Party or anything else. I'm very much an independent, and I vote for the issues that I believe in.
I hear you.
It seems we really need that. We need the primary reform. I'm not doubting at all that we need huge amounts of campaign finance reform, too, to help. But, you know, trying to say that it's not going to make a difference with the independent voters, I think, is basically putting your head in the sand and saying it's not going to make a difference.
If
I could walk in and say, like in Virginia, where it didn't matter if you were, if you were an independent in Virginia, you walked in to whether it was the Republican primary, the Democratic primary, whoever you felt that you wanted to support the most, when you walked in as an independent, you got to vote in one of the two primaries.
I hear you.
It made a heck of a lot more sense.
Yeah, let me put your comments to David McEwen, and she's had a chance to live in three states, and it sounds like three very different experiences.
That's right, but I think it's a fair point in terms of how independents are engaged and at what point they're engaged and what can we do in terms of reforms or labs of democracy to help increase their involvement. It's not that they're unaware of politics or that they have their, even heads in the sand about doing nothing. It's that they are engaged, but they're busy and doing other things. And at what point do you have them get involved in the primary process? What can we do to encourage that involvement? You also have more voters that are realigning from party or are the Republicans in name only, as the caller mentioned, or Democrats in name only. And so you have to address that issue. And I think that's the broader point of Senator Schumer's op-ed, and an important one, is that how do we get moderating influences? Mm. And the way that you get moderating influences is you're going to have to deal with the problem of money in politics. You're going to have to deal with congressional redistricting, with lines. In California, obviously, you have a very robust initiative process that Republicans use a lot because they're out of favor in the legislature. But if you go to Florida, for example, it's the reverse. Democrats use the process heavily because they're out of favor in the state legislature that's run largely by Republicans. So states that have the ballot measure process are also places where we'll see some of this experimentation go on. And we just, frankly, need more experience and more data to have a better handle on what's happening with the open primary season.
Well, and I wonder whether it's also just the public's expression of their frustration with the political system overall. Perhaps it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. If you don't vote, then, certain kinds of candidates win, and then, they get to do things that you don't support, whether it's in the state capitol or in Washington, D.C.
Yeah, that's right. And then there needs to be some type of pressure release valve or some way to express these voters' sentiments and expressions. This frustration at some level isn't new. That we know that this particular year, as we head to November, is going to be a particularly surly, angry set of voters. So there's going to be a lot of voting no. There's going to be a lot of negativity. That's a function of a second presidential midterm, a lack of really any big issues happening. And so what we're going to see is the voters that are not participating so far, these independents, are going to vote. They're going to be asked to dance in November. They're going to vote no. They're going to tell their dance partner they don't want to dance with them. And that can affect dramatically what happens. And it is that message that's very important and consistent, because we don't see much getting done in state capitals for the most part, and certainly in Washington, D.C., where gridlock seems to be more the status quo than anything else.
Well, on that note, thank you so much, David McEwen, for joining us today on Radio Times.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
You're very welcome. And again, he's a professor of political science at Sonoma State University, the third of three guests in this hour of Radio Times. We began with John Mark Hansen. We wanted to get a short history of our primary system, and he's a professor at the University of Chicago. Then we spoke with Tim Potts, a former director of Pennsylvania Democracy Rising, about how Pennsylvania does primaries. We have a closed primary system here in the Commonwealth. Well, that's it for today's edition of Radio Times. A shout out to Joyce Lieberman and to Charlie Kyer helping us out in this hour of Radio Times, and Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times. The show produced by Susan Greenbaum, Debbie Bilder, Emily Bryant, and John Ahrens. For more information about the program, go to whyy.org/Radio Times. You can find out about our weekly newsletter, also Facebook, podcasts, email, archives. It's all there for you to check out. So go to whyy.org/Radio Times. I'm Marty Moscone. Thank you so much for joining us, and do tune in Monday. We'll be back.